we get to see
or not be seen on Friday.
Yeah,
you have to do that.
Like a big deal.
I didn't know there was
radio theory.
When we met last time, it was through.
Okay, we're ready. Okay. House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Thursday, May 4th, 2017. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 257A and call the senators and the senators.
Aaron, can we have our lifeline?
Yes.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Senate Bill 257A expands official misconduct in the first degree to include acts constituting official misconduct in the second degree when the violation places a vulnerable person in danger of physical injury, a sex crime, or the violation will cause the withholding of food, physical, or medical care. There are no amendments, and there is a minimal fiscal and no revenue impact.
Please.
Thank you, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williamson, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee. For your record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Corvallis and Albany and the surrounding areas. Senate Bill 257 came to you from the Senate, obviously. That's why it's called Senate Bill. And 1 o'clock hearings are hard. It's right after lunch. And so Senate Bill 257 addresses the issue of serious cases of official misconduct that are not currently encompassed by official misconduct in the first degree. Second degree official misconduct is currently a Class C misdemeanor. First degree official misconduct is a Class A misdemeanor. So where this bill came from, we had a situation that some of you may know about 2 years ago, where we learned through public records, through a really extraordinary investigation done by the Department of Justice's Charitable Activities Division, that we had a foster care provider that was not only stealing public money, but putting children at significant, not just risk of harm, but actual harm. And meeting with these children afterwards, we learned that they were sexually abused, they were physically abused, they were inappropriately restrained, they were denied food, they were denied tampons, they were locked out of their house. They had a whole series of issues. The other thing that we learned was that it wasn't that this was a provider that was just very good at concealing these issues. DHS workers and attorneys and CASAs and community members were bringing these issues to the attention of the Department of Human Services. People within the Department of Human Services were bringing this to the attention of the leadership of the Department of Human Services. The Department of Justice was bringing these issues to the attention of the Department of Human Services. Through public records, we were able to actually even see emails that said, hey, this place, their facilities don't have licenses. It's against the law to put them there. Kids aren't getting food. There are a whole series of open abuse complaints that involve broken bones. All of the staff have criminal records, and DHS leadership said, keep putting kids there anyway. We saw what the impact of that was, and in the end, that action would be a Class C misdemeanor, because in order for it to be official misconduct in the first degree, you would need to be doing that either for your own personal financial gain, which this wasn't for anyone's personal financial gain, or with the intent to harm a person. And I don't believe that anybody had an intent to harm the person. So what this language does, and why it's not currently encompassed in the first degree, is that it now says that you have to, in order to first of all, there's no behavior that is not currently official misconduct that would become misconduct with this. It's just a matter of which degree. But in order to have your conduct elevated to the first degree, you would have to knowingly fail to carry out a duty that is laid out for you in statute. So one, you have to know that you have the duty. You have to then know that you are not carrying out the duty. Secondly, you have to know that your failure to carry out that duty creates a risk, an actual risk. You have to know that that risk is there, that a vulnerable person is going to be at risk because of your failure to perform your statutory duty of physical or sexual abuse or being denied food or water. So this could be a person in an aging and disabilities program. This is really a lot of residential kinds of programs. It could be foster care. It could be a whole variety of things. And you know that there is that problem. You recklessly disregard that risk. So there you get to the standard of a reasonable person would have known that this was a bad idea and put somebody at risk. In that case, it would then be official misconduct in the first degree, which still is a misdemeanor and would be about a $6,250 fine and a maximum, theoretically, and a maximum of 12 months in prison, which when I look at what happened to the children in this particular circumstance, that is really still a drop in the bucket. Because after what they experienced, the only people that have experienced a criminal penalty have been the children. Children who were running away, children who shoplifted in order to get tampons and food. They are the ones that were held accountable. They are the ones that have lifelong consequences. The adults that knowingly made these decisions, while they should have known, reasonably known, the significant risk that they were putting on these children, have faced no consequences. And that is the issue. The last thing that I would point out is that two things. One question that came up in the Senate was, well, why not just charge the people with assault or sexual abuse? You can't, because they aren't the person that's acting to do that. You can't charge them with a crime that somebody else commits. The second is, would this increase the burden on kind of frontline workers and caseworkers? It should not, as long as the person is doing their job and carrying out the activities that are outlined in the statute. If a worker goes to their supervisor and says, I don't want to place this kid in this placement, and they are directed to do that placement, they are not violating a statutory obligation. There are very few statutory obligations actually that are laid out for frontline workers. This is really going to be more at the administrative level. But right now, I would also finally point to, we have very few cases where we are charging people with official misconduct. I think this is an area in which Oregon needs to do a lot of work. We really do have relatively weak official misconduct and public corruption laws. This really is a public corruption type of a law. And I would argue that some activities when a public official commits such an egregious break of the public trust, that probably the penalty should be a little bit more severe than stealing a Snickers bar from the corner store. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions or listen to my friends.
Okay. Well, excuse me. Good afternoon. Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson and Williamson. My name is, for the record, James Ivory Manning, Jr. I'm a senator from Senate District 7, which is Eugene and Junction City. As a co-chief sponsor of SB 527A, I'm here to convey my support of this bill in addition to what my colleague has so eloquently articulated. So many of the things that she has pointed out, I won't repeat, and I was prepared to do the same thing in the event that she was not here. But what I do want to say just briefly is that this bill represents accountability. It holds people accountable for negligence of duty. It holds people accountable for the abuse or not paying attention to their fiduciary responsibilities when it comes to kids or some of our most vulnerable people that we have here. I think this is a good bill. I am strongly supportive of this bill because what it does is that it combines, it makes sure that we get rid of that little layer where people can just drop through and not be held accountable for the misdeeds that they do for personal gain or whatever the case may be. We all have a fiduciary responsibility to maintain our statutory obligations, and this is what this bill would do. So I won't go any further than that. Again, Senator Gelson said it's so admirably. I appreciate her being here, and thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General of the Oregon Department of Justice here in lifeline function on Senate Bill 257. Official misconduct is a statutory provision that I think even for prosecutors can be difficult to understand. So I wanted to give a little bit of an overview about the relevant criminal law here. So official misconduct in the second degree, it's really very brief. It says if a public servant, that's a broadly defined term that will incorporate pretty much the employees of public bodies, but if we are subject to a statutory obligation and we knowingly violate that statute, it's there. Now, that's tremendously broad. That could cover, theoretically, and I'll note prosecutors have not, to my knowledge, ever applied it to the following example, but just going off of plain language, that could go all the way from a knowing failure failure to file in triplicate all the way up to knowingly placing a child over which I have some official responsibility in harm's way. So it's an extremely comprehensive statutory provision. Under existing law, you get to official misconduct in the first degree under only two circumstances. That obligation, you know, the need to have a statute apply to you and then choose to disregard it, that's still there. But in order to get to that enhancement, you must either, one, be doing that with the intent to enrich yourself in some way, which is, you know, that's your classic corruption. I figured out a way not to follow an obligation, and I padded my coffers in doing so. Or two, you're doing so with the deliberate intent to harm someone else. The choice you are making is to harm someone else. I think the genesis of this proposal is that doesn't do much for a circumstance under which you have a statutory obligation to protect someone, in this case, a statutorily vulnerable person. You choose not to, and you recklessly disregard that obligation, and then that results in the real risk of harm. So that's the basic structure of what this bill does. To address what Senator Gelser touched on in terms of the applicability of other laws, you know, when you have the obligation in a sort of attenuated way to these vulnerable citizens, you are the public official that's responsible for their welfare, they're your responsibility, and they come to abuse of which you are aware, and in violation of statute you do nothing to prevent. They're the usual crimes, things like criminal mistreatment, neglect as it's generally defined, reckless endangerment, will typically not apply. And the reason is what the good senator got at, that it's too attenuated. You didn't actually cause the mistreatment. It was not your action. And typically in criminal law, you need that imminence, that mechanism that makes you the most immediate defendant. So this is a different approach. This looks at it through the lens of what you permitted to happen and the sort of figurative being asleep at the wheel. So again, happy to answer any technical questions. It's a tricky area of the law.
Are there any questions for this panel representative?
Oh, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So some of you know I'm a little troubled by this bill and a little concerned. And I do understand certainly the pieces about, you know, about enriching yourself in some way, shape, or form, or whatever that might be. But I'm just concerned about, well, a couple of different things. I think I mentioned to Senator Gelser that I was concerned that in particular, folks who have done a lot of work for many, many years to get a master's degree in social work would then feel in some way, shape, or form, if they places a vulnerable person in a situation that they know something's wrong, that's just not a legal issue within this statute or this law piece. It's a legal issue with their degree, right? Social workers have a particular place in the world around the things we can and can't do. The two pieces here where it says places a vulnerable person in danger of physical injury, places a person in danger of being a victim of sex crime, and then causes, those words still make me nervous about how that actually works, because we could, you know, whether we intend to or not, or whether we were told to do that anyway, that still leaves you in a place of being responsible in some way, shape, or form. And I worry about how that language is, and that it might be a hard thing, or might turn around on us some kind of way. I'm just very nervous about it. I don't know. You're telling me that it's I don't know. Is it a gray thing or just a?
Sure, I'll go first. Chair Barker, Representative Sanchez, there is one thing that must happen before the placing a vulnerable person in danger of physical injury question is asked, which is the public servant has to violate ORS 162405, which means they have to be aware of and disregard a statutory obligation. So if you're placing a child, or a child is in a circumstance where some danger exists, that by itself won't violate the statute. What it takes is for you to actually consciously ignore a statutory obligation you have. You have to make a choice not to follow the law. If you're ignorant of the law, you're not making the choice not to follow the law. And if the law is silent on the question of whether you're placing somebody in, I mean, if you place somebody in danger, but you otherwise do so lawfully, You know, that you don't violate any laws in placing somebody in danger. You give it your best shot. You're working with the resources you have. You follow, you're following within the statutory guidelines. You should never violate this provision. It requires you to actually consciously choose to ignore a statutory obligation before you even get into the question of vulnerability or danger.
And Chair Barker and Representative Sanchez, I think that was going to be my answer, is that it's a compound sentence. It's the first part is the public servant violates ORS 162.405 and so you have to know that it's a statute. If you are a worker, for instance, and you are being told by your supervisor that you must place a child in a place that it is against the law to place them, you are not at risk of losing your job by refusing to violate the law. If you know that that is breaking the law, is violating that law. So it has to, there has to be a law that says it is illegal to do this action. Two, you have to know that that law exists. You have to knowingly not do that. And then on top of all of that, the rest will occur. In terms of the license, because this doesn't change the breaking of ORS 162.405, which is that second degree official misconduct, already under current law, that same risk would apply to the individual if they were going to be prosecuted for official misconduct in the second degree. The behavior itself, that whatever that action was, would not newly be criminal under this law from what it is today.
If I may,
please,
Chair Barker and vice chairs and members of the committee, Representative Sanchez, you know, when I went through this bill, I was looking at this bill in terms of if you knowingly knew that whatever condition or situation that you were placing a child in, and you knew what the outcome through the previous acts, and you chose, and a person chose to ignore those, knowing that they have caused harm in the past, and didn't take the proper precautions, not necessarily a referral from maybe a caseworker or a social worker, but knowing that this environment did exist, and then you place a child there anyway, and expect a different outcome when there's a history that things have gone wrong over time. There's a case that I remember where there was a judge, and this judge was making money off of locking kids up. This would be something that will hold people like that accountable, because many times, as it is, it's like a screen where certain elements are able to drop through even though they're still doing the same thing. And it's more a piece of being accountable. So I think that this is a good start. It's not the cure-all, but it is a good start because we are concerned about the kids. And, you know, and we can even expand that into our seniors that are in these vulnerable conditions as well.
Sure.
So this is a really important bill here.
And this does cover seniors and people with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
Thank you. Representative Gorsuch.
So anybody can answer this. My main question is, certainly we need to protect vulnerable people. How often have we had the sorts of problems that you're describing?
That's more of a question. Yeah. Chair Barker, Representative Gorsuch, more often than we should have, which has become more clear over the last couple of years. We fortunately have new leadership at the department that is really focused on accountability and kind of looking at enforcing licensing and contracts. And I think, you know, we've talked about this more in the media around foster care and children, but this certainly has been an issue as well in developmental disabilities and elder care and senior care. We've, you know, seen a lot of stories about that in recent times. I think one of the other things that is important when, you know, 2 years ago when we were working on the Give Us This Day situation and we're in conversations with the Department of Justice around what would the accountability piece be for something that is this egregious, one of the issues and one of the things that had to go into the Senate bill was that even to get to it was questionable whether we could even get to second-degree official misconduct because it was unclear if the obligation to make these decisions was clearly outlined in the statute. And so in 1515, there are a couple of very specific and discrete pieces that are put in that are part of the statute. And that statutory description is a description of the director of the Department of Human Services. But the point being, even as egregious as that behavior was in the current law, even with official second degree misconduct, it was you couldn't get there from here. And so it would be very, very, very difficult, given that and how high level and egregious that was, to get there with I am a caseworker and I made a placement in a foster home that made me uncomfortable. I mean, there's not a statute that says it's against the law to place a child in a place that makes you uncomfortable. We do now have a statute that says it's against the law to place a kid in a place that's not licensed and is failing to meet contract standards. We didn't necessarily have that before.
Okay, and I'm sorry, Ruth, follow up, you had.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was following this train right here. So So again, understanding all of these pieces, I really do understand that. I guess my concern overall is for a caseworker who doesn't feel like they have a choice to say no, given our current foster care system where we are hoteling children because we don't have a place to put them, and then they're being told by a supervisor, here's a place. I don't know if that's happening or not still, but my overall concern is that we are, and in my opinion, let me just say, even with a caseworker, which is a hard thing on that caseworker as well, we are putting kids in my opinion, not the best situation in the world when we're hoteling them, right? We're just in a hard place right now, and my concern is for caseworkers and people who are trying really hard to do their job and feel, this makes me feel like they will be vulnerable. They will have a level of vulnerability going on with them because they're not able to do the job to the best of their ability, and there is no options.
And if I may, Chair Barker and Representative Sanchez, first of all, you're exactly right. We are in a horrible place with our child welfare system right now. And that's in large part because we have a devastated workforce. We don't have enough people. We don't have enough training. We don't have enough compensation. We don't have a deep enough bench. We're asking people to be attorneys when they're not attorneys. I mean, we're asking people to do all kinds of things. We have not been recruiting foster families. We're not supporting foster families. And we are in the midst of a crisis that's been about 12 years in the making. I mean, this is something that we should have begun addressing a decade ago. And we did not, because we did not have adequate leadership to do that. This won't fix any of those problems. I will tell you that after we did 1515, one of the requirements of the statutory requirements was that if you were aware that a child was in danger, you were required to make that report. That got communicated to everyone, even if it's not abuse. I mean, there's a difference between abuse and a contract violation or licensing violation that puts a child at risk. What I heard from frontline workers and what happened at the department is those workers started calling because in the past they had been told to be quiet, don't talk about that. They now were able to say, I am required by law to speak up and do this. And once they did that, their obligation was done. They could not be held accountable if they elevated that to the next level and the person at the next level did not do their job. Now, I agree that the job is hard, but I also believe that when you are in a position of public trust, like a caseworker or on the adult side, an APD investigator, we are trusting you with our grandparents and our children, and if you think someone is in danger, you should report that and say that. The law says that. Once you've made that report, your statutory obligation is done. If you are not making that report, I don't care what your job is, I think you should be held accountable for that. Because no matter how difficult it is in the system for the adults, the kids, or the seniors, or the people with disabilities, those are the folks that the system is protecting. And I appreciate the concern. I think we just look at it from different perspectives in terms of the risk. I actually believe this gives greater protection to workers because the law says, you will do this, and your supervisor now can't tell you. You have to be quiet, even though you know that there are that there are issues. And we know this has happened not just with Give Us This Day. We know OnTrack in Medford, we had people calling our office all the time about that, where their supervisors were telling them, be quiet, no, there's rats, the kids are getting drugs put in them, be quiet, don't talk about it. We can't have a system in which we're putting, I think that puts the workers in a much more difficult place.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I look at this, and I too would share the concern that somebody would inadvertently make a decision that they would reap a criminal charge for. But as I look at this and 162.405, it seems pretty intentional to me. It's not a mistake. A public servant commits the crime of official misconduct in the second degree if the person knowingly violates any statute relating to the office of the person. They know they're violating the law. That's just the first part to even continue the conversation. So as I sit here, I'm trying to think of that instance where a decent caseworker with good motives gets stuck in a terrible position. We have very few good placements, and we have a lot of rough placements, and we just don't. We have to acknowledge that and work with that. But we're not talking about placing them in those places we don't think are awesome. We're talking about choosing to jeopardize the health and welfare of that kid and knowing you're jeopardizing the health and welfare of that kid.
In violation of the law, and that you know there's a statute.
Is that a fair statement, I just said?
No. Chair Barker, Representative Springer, I agree 162.405 requires a knowing violation of a statutory obligation. You must know that you had the obligation, and you must choose not to follow it. It is a choice.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. I don't know whether Aaron or Senator Gelser, when I read the summary portion and started digging into it, two things, and you said something, Senator Gelser, that struck me as where I was going with this. Official misconduct needs to be addressed, I think, more so, as you said. When I saw official misconduct and public servant, the first thing coming to my mind was, of course, politicians. We are public servants, and there is a lot of official misconduct, potentially, that can happen. Is that addressed in statute somewhere else that I'm just not reading, I'm not aware of? And the part two of that would be, in just the summary portion there, if we're replacing the word another with vulnerable, instead, if we said instead of another and instead of vulnerable, any, then that would, to me, broaden this to include all official misconduct by any public servant. Does that make sense?
So, Chair Barker, Representative Post, I believe the original version of the bill was broader. The concern about that, about the broader language, if I'm remembering the discussions from early in the session correctly, was that was less clear. We have few places where a public servant is obligated, kind of has a statutory obligation to protect a particular person. I mean, you are looking at you really are looking at, when you're looking at the danger to people, and we had tried to figure out how do you get at property, but we couldn't figure out how to get there. I am satisfied with the narrowness of this, because the public trust of an individual that is tasked with keeping a person safe, who then, not because they make a mistake, but because they know that something is against the law and they do it anyway, and they know that by consciously deciding to do it anyway, they are placing a vulnerable person at risk of these things occurring, and they recklessly disregard. I mean, there are just so many things you have to get through to get here. I would agree. I think in general, our official misconduct language is not adequate. I think it's something we should be looking at in future settings. I mean, there's official misconduct in the legislature, Department of Energy. I mean, just name any place. We should have, I'm not accusing anybody of anything, to be clear, we need stronger public corruption laws in general.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would just say I love killing five birds with one stone if I can, and this is a pretty good stone. So that would be my only concern.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so I have another speaker, but or another person wants to testify on this, but I'm going to hold you because I know Senator Manning has to leave. We'll get him as quick as you can. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 257, open the public hearing on Senate Bill 846.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Senate Bill 846A prohibits the use of restraints in juvenile court proceedings and when DHS or the Oregon Health Authority are transporting youth. It also provides an exception to this prohibition. There are no amendments and there is no fiscal or revenue impact.
Right. Chair, Senator Manning said I could start.
That's fine. And I just want to make clear that I will be calling up the other witness in a bit. So thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much. Senator. Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Williamson, and members of the committee, for the record, I remain Senator Sarah Gelser from Senate District 8 in Albany and Corvallis. This is a bill I'm so excited to bring to you. There's been a great group of people that have been working on this for a while, and you're going to hear from all of them a little bit later. This has to do with the way that we manage and support young people when they are in a crisis. They're in a very difficult situation. They find themselves in a courtroom. And the idea behind this is that during a juvenile court proceeding, a child should not be shackled with ankle bracelets or wrist chains or belly chains unless there is a public safety reason that causes that. A judge has found that based on that individual's behavior, that is necessary in order to keep that that youth safe and to keep the other people in the court safe. The bill requires that that decision be made prior to the court proceeding, but does allow if something happens that a decision can be made at the last minute. We had a good conversation about the challenge of our court facilities across the state. So we originally talked about the restraints would be removed before they entered the courtroom. Not all courtrooms have kind of reception areas where that can take place, and that's why the language talks about before the proceeding begins, before the judge is there. The bill also addresses the issue of kids who are being transported not because they have committed a crime, but they are being transported between foster homes or between residential psychiatric facilities. And I have two stories that I want to share with you that drove me to be involved in this bill. The first is I had a constituent who was struggling to access mental health services. He was 12 years old. He had been at the children's farm home. He had been in their inpatient unit. When he was discharged, he had private insurance, which seems like that might be a great thing, except for the private insurance didn't cover things like in-home support and the wraparound services and the parent training and the family training. So they sent him home. And the family said, oh my gosh, what do we do if he gets in trouble? And they said, call law enforcement. So one day he had a meltdown. There was, I believe it was a boat oar that he was swinging around the house, called law enforcement. He was handcuffed, taken to juvenile detention. Child welfare said, your other children aren't safe, so we'll have to remove them if you bring him home, but they could offer no foster placement to him, so he continued to sit in detention. He eventually went home. The third time he was back in detention, after he had been in detention for about 3 weeks, I'd been to a number of the meetings, and I decided to go to the court hearing, because at that point, my thought was, oh my gosh, we are going to have a child sitting in jail, this little kid, because we do not have an appropriate foster placement, and we are unwilling to provide wraparound services in this family's home because they have private insurance. Services. So a whole variety of public policy issues that we could tackle in that. Got to the courtroom and my heart was absolutely broken to see him come in, shackled at his ankles and at his wrists, this kid who is in court because he has a mental illness that needs to be treated, that he cannot get treatment for, and there is no foster home for him, and he is just waiting. And it was a devastating thing to see. It was a few weeks later that I got a telephone call from a foster parent in Central Oregon. She was serving a young girl who I believe she also was a middle schooler who not only experienced a mental illness but had an intellectual disability. The girl was getting up that morning. She was planning to have her school pictures taken. She was looking forward to a visit from her mother. There was a knock on the door from a caseworker that had never met the child. The foster parent didn't know these people were coming to say, we are taking her. She's being committed to the farm home. This was Bend. She hadn't had breakfast yet. They put her in belly chains and ankle shackles, put her in a car, and drove her from Bend to Corvallis in those restraints. neither of these situations are appropriate. Kids that are struggling need support and care. They don't need chains. This bill, all of the relevant people have come together. There's no opposition to the bill, and I think that this will help us serve and support our kids that have either made some bad choices or struggling with a mental illness in a way that is more developmentally appropriate and is just more appropriate as human beings. So there are great people here that can talk about the specifics of the bill, to me, this is one of the most exciting bills of the session, and I hope that it will earn your support. It really will make a difference for some pretty vulnerable kids.
Okay. For the record, excuse me, my name is James Ivory Manning, Jr. I am the senator from District 7, which is Eugene and Junction City. I'm here in support of SB 846A, and I am proud to say that I am one of the chief sponsors of this bill. I won't go into a lot of detail again because it's kind of hard to follow someone that just nails it right off, give you all of the particulars about this bill. There is a big concern though about transporting kids and stuff in shackles and chains, only to find out that oftentimes these kids are not accused of any crimes or anything like that. It's just standard operating procedure. We have to restrain children. This over time can cause, as you may well know, a psychological impact on the kids. Feel that they've been taken through this, and there's no reason for that. One would have to wonder, experiencing an event like that, does that actually create a pathway to maybe crime? I don't know. I'm not a psychiatrist. I don't have the documentation in that area. But I do know that it could scar a child for the rest of their lives to be treated in a manner such as this. I did have a long testimony that I was going to give. But then again, Senator Gelsler, she laid everything out. She must have took my words and stuff, because so I won't repeat those again. I know how busy you are here, but I do agree with her. This is a very exciting and very special piece of legislation. And it's time that we start looking out for our kids. And some of these things that are scarring children early on in life, we have an opportunity now to prevent that from happening. There are other means and methods to make sure that we're doing the right thing, and mental disabilities or physical disabilities or whatever, learning disabilities, are not the grounds for being shackled and treated like you're some kind of a hardened criminal. It's a devastating thing to the kids, and I urge your high vote to move this out of committee. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Vile.
Thank you very much, Senators. This deals primarily with taking the restraints off before somebody comes into court.
Correct.
The example you gave, Senator Gelsler, of the young lady that was moved from Central Oregon over, does this do anything to address that sort of situation?
Vice Chair Olson and Representative Vile, it does. If you look at Section 3, this has to do with the transportation of a young person by the Department of Human Services, the Health Authority, or an agent of the department or the authority. So this really has two sections. One deals with kids that are being adjudicated there in the court, and the other has to do with what is referred to as secure transportation kind of in psychiatric treatment. It does still allow, if that is actually needed, if a determination has been made on the individual circumstances of the child, that would still be allowed. But instead of just having a blanket policy that's just how we transport people, that would not be the case. What it does not do, and we're very careful with the language, this does not prohibit if you've got a 17-year-old that happens to be a foster child, so in the care of the department, that commits a crime. That does not change the way that individual would be treated. This has to do with that transportation by an agent of DHS or the Oregon Health Authority, not by law enforcement.
Follow up? Go ahead.
So in the case you talked about then, that was just a caseworker moving a child. It wasn't a situation where we had a juvenile offender that was being that. I find that just remarkable that it happened at all then. Mm-hmm. And this is going to still give flexibility for that caseworker, I assume, if they determine that for safety purposes they've got to do something.
Yes, Vice Chair Olson, Representative Vile, the statute talks about that when you could do it is if the restraints are necessary due to an immediate and serious risk of dangerous or disruptive behavior, and there are no less restrictive alternatives that will alleviate the immediate and serious risk of dangerous or disruptive behavior. What this would change is it just being a blanket standard policy that when a child is moved from one place to another secure psychiatric facility, that restraints are always applied. This would be based on the individual behaviors and needs of the child themselves.
Thank you very much.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll have a question in here, I'm sure. This bill causes a lot of thought. And some you may agree with and some you may disagree with. This bill first came to my attention when I was over in La Grande last month. And a cop friend over there came to me and he said, do you know what the Senate just passed? You can't ever handcuff juveniles in court. And I said, let me look into the bill and see. And that isn't the case. But a couple things that just to bring some balance to this conversation a little bit that I want to get out. This isn't always law enforcement doing the handcuffing. And it's not just, shackling is a broad term for all sorts of things. And I can't think of a time I ever shackled a kid. I don't quite know what shackling means. I maybe put leg restraints on a kid once, maybe. But I handcuffed him. And sometimes that, frankly, was for their safety. But always after they'd committed a crime. So the foster kid being transported from point A to point B, being handcuffed, I guess that's the method that would be used. That's a little disturbing. But again, I think there's a question in here. The important piece here is that there will be an avenue, and I think I clearly see it here, an avenue to always petition the court to have that child, that juvenile, in handcuffs, or sometimes it's just leg irons. I've seen people in court with just leg irons because they're a flight risk. But as we talk about this, let's not forget about the kid who, for whatever reason, has all sorts of issues. And the primary reason you're concerned transporting the person is because they'll hurt themselves in the car, the front or the back, probably the back, or try to get out of the car. And sometimes that's still an option. So this isn't just about trying to do bad things to kids. This sometimes is for their own safety, and I want to bring that broader context to the conversation here.
So Chair Barker, Representative Springer, all of your points are very good points. I think the first that's really important to clarify, as it relates to juvenile offenders or alleged juvenile offenders, this is really only about during the court proceeding when the judge is in the room. And there is that method both for before you ever come to say, hey, you know, this kid has this need, so this is just what's going to happen, or on the way there something happens, or the kid says something on the way in, or becomes very agitated during the court proceeding, there are avenues to be able to make that change. But this does not impact transport. I mean, this does not speak at all to the transport from the juvenile detention facility to the court at all. This is just in the room. As it relates to the other kids, yes, I mean, I think that is the reason. It's one of those, intention is good, practice probably most of the time isn't necessary. There are kids or individuals that could be a very severe danger to themselves, jumping out of the car, taking their sweatshirt and trying to strangle themselves. I mean, all of these are stories that I've heard. This allows that to be addressed. What it doesn't allow is everybody being restrained because of the behaviors of a minority of individuals, and also clearly states that restraints may not be used as punishment for convenience or as a substitute for the staff person. It has to be a substitute for staff supervision. You know, you can't go into the 7-Eleven and, you know, restrain the kid to the car. I'm not suggesting anybody's doing this, but this would make it clear that you cannot do that.
Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The one thing, and this may be for a later panel, but I also understand that the norm in terms of the court piece for adults is that they are frequently not restrained, unless, again, they're a problem. Is that correct?
Chair Barker and Representative Gorsuch, I believe that's the case, but I would leave that to the panel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Senator, we'll get to you in a few minutes. Call Mark McKechnie, Amy Miller, and Paula Lawrence. You're still in the list. We have a couple other bills and some other people waiting, so I appreciate it.
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williamson and Olson, members of the committee, thank you for taking the time today to hear testimony on Senate Bill 846A. My name is Amy Miller. I'm the Deputy General Counsel at the Office of Public Defense Services, and hopefully I can answer Representative Gorsuch's question. I first want to say thank you to Senator Gelser and for the other sponsors of this bill. It was a great collaborative effort, including the juvenile department directors and others who came together to try to make sure this was workable for the limitations, staffing limitations, facility limitations, et cetera, and yet still legally permissible. So since 1883, Oregon has recognized the constitutional right of adult defendants to be free from physical restraints during criminal trials. And there's a case law that I cite too in my testimony, but the reasons for that are an infringement on the presumption of innocence and on the dignity of judicial proceedings, an inhibition with consultation with a lawyer, an interference with a criminal defendant's decision to take the stand as a witness. So as a result of these concerns, adult defendants have the right to appear without physical restraint unless there is an individualized and independent court finding of, in the language, an immediate and serious risk of dangerous or disruptive behavior. So in 1995, almost 100 years later, in a case called Milliken, State v. Milliken, the Oregon Court of Appeals extended the same right to juveniles in delinquency proceedings. And what they said is neither the 14th Amendment nor the Bill of Rights is for adults alone. And the Court of Appeals clearly held that routine, indiscriminate shackling of youth in juvenile court proceedings is a violation of the youth's constitutional right to due process and fair trial. But keep in mind that that right is not absolute. It is limited by the immediate risk of serious, dangerous, or disruptive behavior. So since 1995, this practice of restraining youth in court, and typically I've seen this through cuffs, leg irons, and a belly chain, but to speak to Representative Springer's point, a lot of times it can be limited to leg irons if the issue is youth that are running. Since that time, there's been a lot of debate. There's been a lot of change in policies across the state, county by county, and around the country, too. And I reference this in my testimony, but according to the National Juvenile Defender Center's campaign against indiscriminate juvenile shackling, 23 states have limited juvenile shackling through legislation, court rule, or case law, and we are the only state in the whole West Coast area that has not done so. And the reasons for this policy debate and for the action curbing this practice are really twofold. First, just like adult defendants, youth are entitled to the fundamental rights of a fair trial, an adequate defense, and the presumption of innocence. Indiscriminate shackling interferes with these rights. And second, research on adolescent development shows that shackling can be harmful to youth. And you heard Senator Manning speak about that specifically. Included in OLIS is an affidavit from Dr. Beyer, who's a national expert in the relationship between adolescent development, trauma, and disability. And she actually testified on the Senate side about the information contained in her affidavit, and it was fascinating. And what she talks about is that the experience of being restrained can make a young person feel humiliated. It can interfere with the development of positive self-identity. It can compromise moral development. It can contribute to mistrust of the juvenile or of the justice system, and actually can exacerbate sort of trauma-related coping mechanisms. And if you talk with practitioners, and Paula will talk more about that, sometimes youth react more when they're restrained than they do if they're not. There are a number of national organizations who have also issued statements in opposition to indiscriminate shackling: the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges, the Child Welfare League of America, the American Bar Association, the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, the National Association of the Council for Children, and the American Association of Prosecuting Attorneys. All this being said, in Oregon, this practice continues in many jurisdictions. So I did a survey in 2015, and what I found is that it's almost a half and half. 12 Oregon's counties routinely and indiscriminately shackle youth during court proceedings, while in 10 of Oregon's counties, youth are rarely, if ever, shackled during court. 3 counties shackle youth inconsistently. 6 of Oregon's counties have written policies about when to do this and when not to. And I think the message from this is, one, although there is case law establishing this presumption of being restraint-free in court, it's not consistently applied. And second, the other piece is that safety and order can be maintained even in jurisdictions that limit juvenile shackling. So Senate Bill 846 codifies the holding in the Milliken case. The juveniles have the right to be free from shackles during court proceedings unless the court finds an immediate and serious risk of dangerous or disruptive behavior. You heard Senator Gelser say that the bill also accounts for facility differences in the courthouses by setting the presumption that youth are to be brought into the courtroom free of restraints, but also acknowledging that if that's not a possibility, if that's not a safe way to make that work, that it can be done prior to the start of the court proceeding.
I'm going to be losing some of my members, and I'd like to.
Oh, sorry. I was speaking quickly, but not quickly enough. Anyway, in summary, if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, refer to the materials that are on the list. Thank you.
Ahead, Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the Executive Director of Youth Rights and Justice, and you get a twofer today. I'm also testifying as a member of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association on their behalf, so saving you one right there. We are also, both YRJ and OCDLA are in support of Senate Bill 846A, and want to thank Senator Gelser and the other sponsors, including Representative Williamson and Post, who have signed on as sponsors to this bill. I won't repeat what's already been said, but I think the critical thing to keep in mind above all else is that we're really talking about the indiscriminate use of restraints on children, and that we need to have policies and procedures to define when they are appropriate. And I think we know, and there's broad agreement among different stakeholders, including law enforcement, juvenile departments, judges, is that the number of cases when it's actually necessary are very small. They're a small minority. And that shackling or restraining youth by default is not a good practice, and it's harmful to both youth who've experienced trauma and are experiencing harm by being restrained, and it causes harm to their due process rights in the juvenile proceeding. So I think a few key principles that I believe everybody agrees with on this bill is that having clear and consistent procedures benefits everyone, all the stakeholders and parties in the court proceeding, the court, the juvenile department, law enforcement, prosecutors and defense attorneys, and the youth, by instilling predictability and consistency and engendering fairness, that being free of restraints is an issue of due process for juveniles, that courts will run more efficiently when the question of restraints has been raised and addressed prior to the scheduled time of the substantive hearing, that most youth brought into juvenile court do not pose a substantial safety risk, and that when it's appropriate, the court should focus their attention on the small number of youth who may pose some risk to cause harm or to flee. And that placing these rules in statute makes them clear and accessible to everyone who needs to understand them. So we urge your support of Senate Bill 846A. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I'm Paula Lawrence, Chair, Vice Chair, members of the committee. I've been an attorney for 25 years. I do have some written testimony, which I understand has been submitted, and I understand you're short on time. The thing I would like to point out, and just from listening to the questions, is that kind of being the attorney that works in the trenches here, is that the kids that are actually coming to court in the restraints are not the kids that you would suppose. When I first became interested in this issue, you know, I was talking to friends and they'll say things, well, what about, you know, natural and logical consequences? You know, those kids are thugs. Let's, you know, scared straight, all that kind of thing that, you know, they're saying, let's not make them enjoy detention. Let's not make them enjoy coming to court. But the thing is that the way Oregon law works is that, you know, once you actually look into this area, the kids that are coming to court are the ones that are not being released from detention. Why are they not being released from detention? They're not being released from detention because there's some kind of a barrier, and it has nothing to do whether they're thugs or not. The barrier is that maybe they've got parents that are inappropriate to release them to. So unlike adults who can be released to themselves, kids are the product of, you know, of who their, you know, their parents are, and that the court won't release them to their parent. You've got kids The ones that I see stay in detention and come back to court again and again are your autistic youth, kids with the Asperger's. I've got reactive attachment disorder youth. That is a very common client of mine that ends up staying in detention a lot. Youth with trauma because of, you know, behavior issues. And these are youth that are also waiting for perhaps, you know, placement options, and they're being, you know, brought to court. And those are the kids that are being restrained. The kids that are the thuggy ones that everyone thinks about, those are the kids that just get, you know, a 1, 2, 3, 4 day probation hit. They don't even go to court. Their probation officers give them that. They're getting their time out in detention, and then they're gone. So I just wanted to make sure people, you know, kind of understand that. And then also, I would really recommend the Dr. Beyer affidavit, because one of the things that I see again as a practitioner is that if we're going to be restraining these youth, and you look at the Dr. Beyer's affidavit, there are harms that happen from the public humiliation of the perp walk with the restraints on the youth, whether they're soft restraints or shackles, whether they're just, you know, handcuffs on the hand, or whether they're also on the ankles. That the harm happens upon, you know, doing that publicly, walking them into the courtroom that way. Also, the binding, that's something that's very, it has a special effect on trauma youth, and trauma youth are the high percentage of what it is that we have in detention. So I would actually, you know, my particular interest is we don't put too many options to allow exceptions for kids to be brought into court and even, you know, trotted down the hallway. What they're doing right now in my courthouse is that when the youth's case is called, they basically sit in the court in the restraints. And then only when their case is called, when they're up at council table, are the restraints being taken off of them. That's a very public act right there in my courtroom, where the kids are standing up in front of everybody in the entire courtroom being unlocked right at that moment. Then for 2 minutes while they're standing at council table, they're off. And then the probation officer is up there, you know, hooking them back up and sitting them down in a chair in the courtroom. So I would just, you know, suggest that any, you know, legislation that doesn't account for that, I think, is we're missing the boat on what it is that we're trying to do for these kids. And that's what I have. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much, panel. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 846. Open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 846A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves Senate Bill 846A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Williamson will be the carrier. And Ms. Molina, we'll be to you pretty soon. I'm sorry, but I need to move another senator up first. Senator Olson, you want to come on up, and I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 323.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Senate Bill 323A creates the offense of arson incident to the manufacture of a controlled substance in the first and second degree. There are no amendments. There is a possible fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Vice Chair Williamson Olson, and members of the committee. My name is Alan Olson. I'm a senator. I represent Senate District 20, the heart of Clackamas County. In January, I read an article about a gentleman that was cooking hash and making hash oil and caused a fire. And I thought it was appropriate to take a look at that because I knew it would be a problem with the growth of marijuana in our state. And it turns out that our laws dealt specifically with the cooking of methamphetamine. And so I brought forward this bill to make it a crime if you are cooking or manufacturing a controlled substance. And in the process of sitting in Judiciary Committee and talking about it, good attorneys that are sitting behind me had said that this could possibly cause a problem with some legislation they were working on. And there was also a concern about making further Measure 11 considerations. So with due diligence, I said, well, can you help me write a bill that would meet the needs that I think we should have, which is filling a loophole on methamphetamine, and but yet not encroach upon the work you're doing. And they did that. It was a wonderful job. It's a wonderful bill. And basically what it says is that if you are engaging in an activity that is creating a drug, making a drug, and you cause a fire, you can be charged with either a Class C or a Class A felony. And with that, I will let the attorneys, who are much more knowledgeable than I concerning this legislation, talk about it. But I will say that I think it's an important tool in the judicial toolbox so that we don't let any folks that are nefarious in their deeds slide through a little crack in the judicial system that they could possibly do, predicated on the fact that methamphetamine was specifically spelled out in the other law. Thank you very much. I'll take any questions.
Any questions for Senator Olson? Thank you, Senator, and sorry for the delay getting you up.
Thank you.
Okay, Scott Winkles, Gail Meyer, and Rob Brovet.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Bovet, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties, here today representing AOC, the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, the Oregon District Attorney's Association, in favor of this bill. This bill addresses clandestine meth labs that catch fire or explode. Nearly all such labs in Oregon are either meth labs or VHO labs that the senator described. However, there is a little gap. It's all of those labs that don't fit into one of the two former types. We get about one or two of those a year, typically DMT, MDMA, and I can spell these out for you if you'd like, dimethyltryptamine, methylene, dioxine, methamphetamine, gamma hydroxybutyrate. We get about one or two of these a year. This essentially creates parity for all types of clandestine drug labs. I know it has a minimal fiscal. I would suspect it's actually a sub-minimal fiscal because these are quite rare and quite exotic. And this just would treat those exotic labs at the same level that we're now treating clandestine BHO labs and clandestine meth labs. Happy to answer any questions if you have.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We are neutral on the bill, and we want to thank Senator Olson for working with us. And the fix was the first instinct the senator had was to insert this conduct into the Arson 1 statute, so Arson 1 and Arson 2. Our problem was Arson 1 is a Measure 11 offense, and so you'd be expanding yet further Measure 11. So the fix was to create its own crime, the crime of arson incident to the manufacture of a controlled substance with its own ORS number. And because it will be now distinct, it won't get sucked into Measure 11. So these will be a discrete statute with discrete penalties, but they won't be subject to mandatory minimum penalties. And for that, we thank the senator for cooperating with us in that.
Okay, thank you, Scott.
For the record, Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm appearing in favor of this legislation. League notes that the drug trade, illegal drug trade, does tend to be fluid, and there are trends and patterns. And in the event that the exotics that were described by my colleague, Mr. Brovet, become less exotic and more ubiquitous, we will have a tool in place that can address this ahead of time. What we've done previously to address meth labs and the BHO fire, butane hash oil fires, has been reactive, and we view this as proactive.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Yes, and this is for anybody who can answer it. How can we carve out a Measure 11 crime? How can we draft an arson crime that's not Measure 11 just because we give it a new statutory number and a new place in the statute?
Chair Barker, Representative Williams, precisely. So in 2005, when we added meth labs to the arson statute, we actually added them to Arson 1 and Arson 2. So what we did to address BHO labs in Senate Bill 302 that is now on the books was essentially create mirror statutes that aren't in Measure 11. But the operative language is identical. We just avoided the Measure 11 implication by not putting it in that Measure 11 statute. We've done the same thing here with Senate Bill 323.
And Representative, the arson statute came in later, too. It had something, I checked with the LC on that.
Do we have an LC opinion on it? or anything written?
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I checked with Jessica Manifi, who drafted this from Legislative Council. I didn't ask her to draft a formal opinion, although it is in writing in the sense it's by email. And she indicated that Arson 1 was not in the version of Measure 11 approved by the people in 1994. It was added legislatively in 1997 by Section 2, Chapter 852, Oregon Laws, 1997. And so because of that, it doesn't affect the Measure 10 prohibition on working around Measure 11 by initiative sentences put forth by the people, since this one wasn't added by the people. It was added by the Legislative Assembly.
Thank you.
Thank you. Maybe we're going to speak about something that's the same, but I look forward to hearing what you have to say, too. When we were working with the marijuana statute, it was in 2016? No, it was earlier this session. Feels like a year ago. I appreciate very much the approach that has been taken here to create this arson crime, but separately from the Measure 11 space. And I appreciated the creativity that went into, and I think Ms. Stevens and Mr. Bovet, you were both part of this conversation, trying to make sure that butane hash oil explosions, which absolutely need to be subject to severe penalties if they're from clandestinely illegally operated labs, that we could punish those offenders in a way that was distinct from expanding the universe of Measure 11 crime. So while Senator Olson's description of this bill was a little unclear to me how it related to the work that we did in 302, I appreciate your clarification of the fact that these two fit together in a complementary way, and in fact, it's the same approach structurally to what you insightfully suggested we do for marijuana.
And Chair Barker, Representative Leininger, I maybe if I could clarify how we got here, and that would probably answer your question. So Senator Olson crafted Senate Bill 323 to add, basically, mostly to add BHO labs to Arson 1 and Arson 2. Measure 11 implicated, because he wanted something on the books to address BHO. He didn't understand that Gail and I and you were working on doing that in Senate Bill 302. And so we went and talked to him and said, well, actually, we think your bill is good if we can cover the exotics, because he was going to cover everything that wasn't a meth lab. So we took care of the bulk of his concern in 302, but then we still have these exotics. And so that's why we've created a parallel provision. So we actually don't need to use what Legislative Council said and create an exception to Measure 11. We're just creating a parallel statute that we're not inserting into Measure 11.
Chair Barker, if I might just add my piece to that. It's not that we're removing anything out of Arson 1. We're not. We're taking the structure of Arson 1 and under Arson 2, mirroring it, calling it a new crime name with a new ORS number, and then therefore by ORS reference, it will not be subject to Measure 11. Does that make sense?
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much, panel. Okay. Close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill
323. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 323 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves Senate Bill 323A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Vile.
Because I haven't been here for a lot of these discussions over the last few years, I'm just curious. That last comment was the most telling in the whole series of testimony, that we're really moving something out of Measure 11 that essentially would have been there. Or did I misunderstand that?
It's the opposite.
It's
not moving anything.
Not moving anything out.
We just created something new.
Mm-hmm. But in essence, it would have been a Measure 11 if we didn't have this new one now to fit it into. Is that?
That could have.
No, it wasn't a crime.
Right? Well, arson, it's arson.
Yeah, it
would have been arson.
Yeah. Right, yeah, it would have been either first, second degree arson. Yeah.
Which,
if I could, okay, Chair please, Barker, yeah, members of the committee, Representative Vile, that was actually the exact question I asked Jessica Maniffy in Legislative Council is if we're taking, because this mirrors the language in Assault 1, although it doesn't take anything out of Assault 1, and it addresses Arson 1, sorry. Doesn't take anything out of Arson 1, and it's addressing different conduct, but it does mirror some of the language and arguably could go into Arson 1. And so the question that I had posed to Legislative Council was this, basically doing an inappropriate end run around Measure 11, and that's where their answer was that because Arson 1 was not added to the mandatory minimum or Measure 11 by the people, that it doesn't create those concerns in Measure 10. I think it might be an open question if it was the opposite and something that the Legislative Council would have had to look at further. But because Arson 1 was not in the 1995 Measure 11, what was put forth by the people, it doesn't create those concerns. Hopefully I'm not being confusing.
No, I think I understand. And if my colleagues who've been around for some of these conversations before are comfortable, I guess I am too.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so we have the motion to move the bill. Is there any, we had discussion, are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered, and Representative Olson will be the carrier. So Representative Gelser, did you want to come back up on your next, on the next bill, then we'll get that out of the way. And then finally, Ms. Molina will be able to come up. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 751.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Senate Bill 751A prohibits a marriage application license or record provided by the state registrar from requiring the address of a religious organization or congregation authorized to solemnize marriages. There are no amendments, and there is no revenue or fiscal impact.
We won't be moving this one today, but so.
All right. Representative Barker, Vice Chair Olson. For the record, my name is still Sarah Gelser, and I still represent Corvallis and Albany and the surrounding areas. Senate Bill 751 is really a very, very simple bill. This is the problem. Currently, when you officiate a wedding, you go and you've got to fill out the, and I don't know how many of you here have officiated, I've officiated, you fill out the form at the end, and you have to put your name, your address, and your telephone number, and then the name, address, and telephone number of the congregation in which you were ordained, or, you know, deemed qualified to perform that marriage. This is the problem that was brought to me by a constituent of mine. She is a pastor. She was ordained in the Baptist Church. She has conducted many, many weddings. She went to graduate school, invested her time, her heart, and her spirit in becoming ordained and is a person of great faith. However, the congregation that authorized, ordained her, that is somewhere in the South, no longer exists. So she can't fill that part out on the certificate, and you are not allowed to leave it blank, nor can you put not applicable. So she was advised that what she should do is go online and get an online ordination from the Universal Church of Life. And as a person of deep faith who committed a lot of time, resource, and prayer to going to divinity school, she found that kind of offensive, and I would tend to agree. So I would argue that a person who is qualified to perform a marriage should not suddenly become unqualified because their church or their synagogue no longer has a telephone number. The only thing that this bill does is it removes the requirement to write down the address and telephone number of the authorizing congregation. You will still have the telephone number and address of the officiant and the name of where you came. Some of the questions that came up on the other side were, why not just put not applicable? You can't. Why not write down a fake phone number? Because you're a pastor and it's a legal document. Why does it matter if you can just get the Universal Church of Life? It does. I mean, if you're a pastor, that you've invested a lot in doing that. It's very simple. It does nothing else. It doesn't change who can get married, who can conduct a marriage. It just takes the telephone number off, and the clerks are fine with the bill. And I really urge your aye vote, because last session it died at the end, and I had a very unhappy constituent.
Okay. Any questions, Representative Springer, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what occurs now, you said they have to put the name of the church they're affiliated with, but we have people officiating marriages that aren't affiliated with a church. So how do those people now fill? you do marriages. So I'm assuming, well, tell me how you do that.
Okay, so Chair Barker, Representative Springer, this is important. It's not just the church you're affiliated with. It is the church that actually ordained you. It's that place. So it's not that now you live in another place and now you put your new church. They didn't ordain you. It's that original place. The way that I did it is I went online and did the Universal Church of Life thing. And even as a person that is not a pastor, I was a youth minister for a long time. My faith is very important to me, and it felt actually kind of icky when I wrote that down. But that is the only way right now that I could officiate a marriage, and I had several people that I wanted to be able to do that for. I can't imagine how much more difficult that would be for a person that actually is a priest, a pastor, a minister, a rabbi. It just doesn't make sense because of a phone number.
Thank you. Any other questions?
This is complicated because some clergymen are named by a larger body than a single congregation. Mm-hmm. And in some denominations, it's a single congregation, the congregation that does the ordination. And the problem, and this is a big problem, and we ought to just do away with that. But the other thing would be to use the address of a church you're currently affiliated with. But I think the solution is a simpler one.
Thank you. Representative Brown.
Didn't we have a bill earlier in the session that essentially said it didn't matter what kind of organization you were part of, you could perform?
Right. It's all an association.
Actually, no. I think it was my bill we were talking about, and I think it simply substituted a humanist, a secular organization. I think under that, they would need to put down the name and address of the secular organization that was naming them as an officiant. It would be the same problem.
Correct. And Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, Representative Vile, and I think that even if we just fixed it in the secular bill, that wouldn't solve the problem for my constituent, because she would then need to go join a secular organization that would authorize her to officiate, although she is currently allowed to officiate. She happens to be a Baptist. The polity of the Baptist Church is once you are ordained, you're always ordained, and that rests with the congregation, not with a kind of larger, Baptist church. So she has no way out of this problem.
Mr. Chair, I think Senator Gelser just touched on the thing that's kind of bothering me. I was authorized to perform marriages back in the 80s when I served for 6 years as bishop in my congregation in the LDS church. Mm-hmm. Once I was released from that position, I no longer had the authority given to me by the organization. I guess what this is bringing up to me is it all feels very much like a fiction to me, because we're asking for this set of information that I can't imagine anybody's doing anything with, or checking whether the Baptists once ordained, always ordained, and the Mormons not that, et cetera. It's troubling me that we're spending the resources of the legislature on it. Senator Gelser, I'm going to support the bill because I agree that it's not appropriate for your constituent to be hung up like this, but I really think we ought to address this where it really needs to be addressed, and that is do away with the fiction and really recognize what, as a society, we're doing in terms of requiring authority before someone is declared married.
Yeah, my original bill had the ability of the couple to solemnize their own marriage. That seemed to me to make a lot of sense. Nobody liked that option.
Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Barker. So a similar question, just worded a little different than Representative Biles. As he mentioned, I know there are organizations that they can revoke your ordination, or and therefore, and then there are some where when your term is up, that's it, and some that never check back in on it. And therefore, the question might be with the specific scenario that you were getting at, is this, if that organization no longer exists, is their ordination still valid?
Chair Barker, Representative Stark, in this case, yes, and she also has her master's in divinity. It's Dr. Susan Shaw from Oregon State University. But I think the thing is, we have this issue where we are making a decision about whether or not someone can perform a marriage based on whether or not they can provide a telephone number. I do not believe that anybody right now is calling that telephone number to see if Representative Vile was released from being a bishop, or to see if the church is still open, or if the person ever actually was ordained there. I mean, it's as you said, I don't think anybody is calling these telephone numbers to say, should we really let this person conduct this marriage. It's just something that has to be filled out that doesn't make a lot of sense, that is preventing some good people of faith from conducting weddings unless they violate their faith by going online and getting an ordination from a fake church.
Mr. Chair, can I also point out, anybody can officiate a marriage. The question is, who signs the form solemnizing it? So you're mother-in-law can officiate at your wedding, and then you go down to the county clerk and have them solemnize it. It isn't the officiating, it's this last step that's some crazy business.
Okay, thank you. It would seem to me that we need to change the form and eliminate the meeting, but would be the answer.
That's what the bill does. The bill changes the form. It says you don't have to write that down anymore.
Okay. So I'm not going to move the bill today because I know there's the potential conflict between the two bills, between the solemnization, so we want to get that resolved.
Okay.
So we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 751. And my speaker who is waiting and waiting and waiting. Just in time.
Reopen.
Come on up. Come on up. Reopen Senate Bill 257A. And call Monique Molina, please. Sorry for the delay, but
it's okay.
Protocol.
Thank you so much for having me here. Chair Barker, Vice Chair Olson, for the record, my name is Monique Molina, and I'm testifying in opposition to Bill 257A. This bill, and no disrespect to the carrier, I believe that she was trying to do a good job while drafting it, but I think it has major unintended consequences. I've met with some of you beforehand to talk about how the bill actually could be used as a target for families living in poverty and with mental illness. I listened to Senator Gelser testify, and she used examples for this bill based on situations that happened last year with kids in institutional settings. And it kind of made me wonder why she's coming up with another bill if she already made one for SB 1515 that ensures that these kids are safe. I do want to add, too, that I previously met with Senator Gelser last year to talk about the concerns of more funding to DHS and less funding to early intervention services for families. And I addressed my experience through the foster care system and becoming an at-risk mother, sharing that information with her to help her see that that abuse and neglect is sometimes often inevitable and that it's not a choice. I think this bill is coming from recent events that I've seen in the media, that I've seen on OLIS, that I've seen and heard through OPB. Senator Gelser can be found saying things such as, would you rather prefer children being dead or put in the foster care system? Or things such as, we need to rethink the way that we care for our children and the rights of parents. things that I'm seeing are implying that this bill isn't directly targeted towards these institutions and residential facilities in foster care, but more so of parents that are at risk living in poverty with mental illness. And so moving forward, I guess I wanted to just share a little bit about my experience growing up in care and kind of what I took away from it and also how it impacted my ability to be a mother, just so you guys can have an informed decision as to whether or not this bill is a good idea. I would like to go through the bill, but for time's sake, I'm not sure if any of you read my amendments that I did draft for the bill and the questions that it has raised, but I'd be more than happy to share that with you if you wanted to go through it and see exactly.
We're not going to move the bill today, so you'll still have time. You could, Representative Sanchez has some concerns as well.
Okay. So I do just want to add that kind of talk about foster care and my experience. I think that's the only place in the world where children who have just been ripped from their parents aren't given the ability to grieve. They are forced into situations where they are abused and neglected, and they are homeless. They're put into a system where they're sex trafficked, where they are pumped with psychotropic medications, where they are beaten by adults in the system that believe that it is their fault that they're in there in the first place. Foster care, I spent 19 years in there. I was taken from my mother when I was born. She had a mental illness, and she was a single mother, and she also was an orphan. I'm the youngest of four, so it was four of us. And it, I think just summing it up, it just felt like some sort of foster care, felt like some sort of punishment. Those feelings never changed over the 19 years of moving through 14 placements. And when it came to being put in unsafe housing situations, I was left in one for 15 years. My siblings and I were left in one for 15 years, and it was a foster mill where they hoarded kids, and they abused us just because we were, because we had a stigma attached to us. And whenever you tried to come out about it to a social worker, no matter what time it was, from when I was little to when I was 19, social workers, they would make it somehow be and seem and make you feel like it was your fault, that they would just remove you instead of addressing the issues. And and I think that just really does something to a human being. It does something to their self-worth. It does a lot of damage. And you know, you just don't understand why that's all happening to you. I think as an adult now, you kind of look back and you're like, what did my mother do to me for me to deserve all that for 19 years? Well, nothing. My mom didn't do anything to me, but she had a drug addiction, and she had a mental illness problem that just wasn't helped through services. And so you turn 19 and you're kind of just kicked out of this system, and you're just trying to convince the judge that you deserve to get a high school education, that you're just as normal as anybody else. And you know, you're young and you kind of think, okay, well, a baby would kind of fill that space that you lost because you experienced so much loss with the moves and being stripped from your family. your entire family. And if I can just, because I'm a visual learner, if I can just demonstrate what my life was like before foster care, and what it was like during the process until after, just being removed from, you start out like this, and then you're removed from your mother and your dad, you're removed from your siblings, you're removed from another home. Whether or not you were attached to those providers, every move is traumatizing, and it strips a little bit from you. And so when you're leaving the system, you're just in pieces, and you have your baby, and you're thinking, like, I'm going to start all over again, and I'm going to raise this kid, and I'm going to have a second shot at having a family. And I named my son Phoenix because I wanted him to rise from the ashes, and I wanted something. I wanted to break that cycle. However, at 21, the time I became a mother, you just find yourself with this baby, and you don't know how to attach to it. You don't know how to care for it. No one's ever really taught you. And there's no one around you to help you with that. You're just kind of forced into this asylum for the rest of your life when you're removed from your families. It's just you. You've been isolated from your siblings for years. You don't know where they are. And so you don't even really know what's wrong, what you're going through, or that you have a mental illness issue from foster care. And so there was just nowhere to really turn to and no one to talk to when you find yourself unable to care for your child. You're afraid to attach to it because you're afraid to lose. And you call the state and say, and you do the bravest thing because, you know, you need to help yourself, and or you're going to keep hurting your child. And I made that call, and they told me that they couldn't help me, that that my baby, I had to abuse or neglect my baby first, but I didn't want to. And, you know, I was doing, like, everything I could to ensure that he was safe, but I failed to keep him safe because of the conditions I was put under that most people don't have to really deal with, or they don't even know what it's like.
I need to ask you to summarize, too, because people have to...
Okay. If I can just sum up the feeling of these women with these children that are unable to take care of them, it's similar to not being able to conceive, and it's you want your child and you love your child, you just know that there's something missing, that you don't have the ability to care for them, and there's no one around to help you. And so in sum, when it comes back to Gelser's bill, if you read the language, and again, I've bolded it and pointed out where the issues are that really put families that are experiencing mental illness and poverty at greater risk. I think what we need to be looking at here is the way we treat these families when they are experiencing struggles, and not penalizing them for things that they cannot help. Gelser likes to argue that it's inevitable. I like to argue that it's not, from my experience. We're all concerned about children's safety, and I think there's another way around keeping children safe by giving parents a choice. People want to do well. They don't want to harm their babies. And if we look at the data, majority of children entering foster care are under the age of one. They're infants, and they're being taken from their mothers. If I can just recommend solutions, I would just say the services that these families need, it's already in the legislative findings in 418-578 that we know about the effects, the intergenerational abuse and neglect that come from taking kids from their mothers, and that we just aren't providing those services. If we can find a way to have parents be inclusive in this process, to where instead of just coming in and ripping a child from a mother and taking them and not telling the mother where the child's going, or keeping them away from their child and giving them services that are not beneficial to them or they have no support in accessing, I believe that kids would be more safe. Women shouldn't have to choose between the fear of having their child removed or admitting to being at risk and experiencing those things that they are at home.
Thank you.
And so, yeah, if you guys want to talk to me afterwards, I would be more than happy. I know I'm being kind of pushed for time, but I would appreciate if you all really took into account my experience and my solutions that I have to offer. So thank you so much.
Thank you, and thank you for taking the time and coming in and sharing those experiences with us.
Yeah, thank you.
So with that, we'll stand adjourned. Stand adjourned. With that, we'll...